Good afternoon. It's 5:30, not 5 o'clock. Slight glitch in the matrix, but I'm very glad to welcome my guest this week, Sasha Romanovich, who I have been circling around for several years, a big fan of her leadership in, which I first came across when, to my mind, she very brilliantly declared as the head of Grant Thornton, they'd no longer bid on FTSE 100 companies and threw the cat amongst the pigeons. With the regulator, and as a recovering chartered accountant dating back to 1989, and the constant struggle has always been who gets the audits, but that was way back then. I then got really fascinated with things that were happening in GT as a social enterprise. A lot has then happened, and now Sasha is, I believe, heading up Fair for All Finance, which is a equality is a huge theme for me and many of my guests, and equity. And so therefore I'm super excited to have you on board. Plus I had 3 weeks off because I just had major surgery, which I've recuperated from. So I'm kind of celebrating being back at the desk. So, half an hour delayed, but not a problem. Welcome, Sasha.
Thank you. And thanks for your flexibility. And I'm very impressed that you've got through major surgery and you're happy to be at a desk.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I have a number of clients, as you'd imagine, and They're all going, no, take time off, it's fine, it's whatever. I'm going, no, you have to understand that I am limiting my calls, but I get totally energized. I love what I do. I get energized by talking to my clients, helping them work through things, and, you know, and I work in leadership with clients, that's my day job. So how are you, and what's on your mind? Oh, and perhaps a little intro about yourself beyond my little intro from my perspective.
Yeah, So thank you for having me. And yeah, time has flown. So just in terms of a bit about me, I'm sort of a bit of a weirdo because I did chemistry at uni and then I trained as an accountant. I went off in 98 and had a bit of an eat, pray, love kind of year and then still came back into the profession, but having sort of profoundly shifted my views in terms of what the world was about and the difference you could make. Had wonderful opportunity with Grant Thornton to really try and shift the world through business in that way. And then left end of 2018. And then got involved in Fair for All Finance, which is really an opportunity to try and actually change a system that isn't working terribly well for people. You know, an interesting journey, and then sort of to go into an organization that's trying to change a system that isn't working terribly well for people, what we call is people in vulnerable circumstances, so people without very much money, and then to go into a global pandemic. The last couple of years have been a tad of a whirlwind. And I was thinking on the way over, you know, just in terms of that sort of whole conversation, in terms of what's on my mind, and I think I'm a bit odd because the stuff that worries me a lot is this whole dynamic of when you see a sort of a system that's not working well for a lot of people, mm-hmm. and you can see that situation getting rapidly worse and having some of the levers that can maybe make it a bit better. And just try that continual thing of trying to figure out what else can I do that will be quicker, more impactful to make a difference to people for whom things are really tough right now, and how to deal with that. Sometimes there are lots of things in systems that time and money is being spent on that are a waste of time. Everyone knows is a waste of time, and yet nobody can really change it. Mm. And yet if only we could change that, that could potentially unlock something else. So that probably all sounds a bit cryptic, but maybe we can explore it in terms of the conversation.
Yes and no, but contextually, you know, I when I joke about being, I put my hand up and say, with apologies to AA members, I'm a recovering accountant. The first thing is recognizing you have a problem. But I say that when I work with accounting firms and law firms, because it gets you credibility, because they've competence comes before character. But one of the Sisyphean struggles with working with like large accounting firms is getting their head, and the same with the law firms, is getting their head out of the tactical.
Yeah.
And saying, like, okay, we need recovery rates, we need utilization. So actually turning around and going, how do I transform the long-term outlook for our clients, for our people, for our firm? And that's in a business space, but that's quite radical. And, you know, I looked at what you made efforts to do, and, you know, my gut feel with GT UK was that you went a little bit too far ahead of the pack, and they just kind of knifed you in the back a little bit. But that's my perspective. I've done a ton of work with BDO globally and in Canada. They're a similar size firm, and I've had the head of BDO Global on there, Keith Farlinger, and the head of BDO Canada, Pat Kramer, both of whom I know very well. But they had to take a look and go, look, we have to radically change the big stuff. So when we look at equity and opportunity for those who are more vulnerable and disadvantaged, which in the UK and most economies is a huge issue, it feels like a difference between the tactical and operational, like the stuff we have to do now, but recognizing that there are these fundamental shifts that need to happen. And it must be very challenging to just find where's the balance to strike? Where can any individual, any organization move the levers? Because it's very political, right? It's also to do with the political direction of the country and what voters are willing to do. But it's just, you know, it's just interesting because you bring a wealth of senior leadership experience in larger organizations. And, you know, how do you apply that in a charity space? And it's much more about the levers you can draw on with other people, I would imagine, than the sort of budget you can deploy.
One of the reasons I took up the role was that it was quite a unique opportunity. I mean, when I was at Grant Thornton, and so many fantastic people there, and I had the opportunity to test and experiment some things that few firms would have been ready to try out at that stage, to be frank. So forever grateful for that opportunity. But when I was there, I started working, looking at some of the big societal issues, but working with government, civil society and business, and starting to bring together some people through that under the Inclusive Economy Partnership. And it was through that that we started to look at financial inclusion. And it was really interesting because when I was thinking about what I might do next, I kind of thought I might do something that was about the sort of big existential crisis around climate change, right? You know, right. That sort of like, you know, that one really needs sorting out. And it was the more I got into some of the work in terms of financial inclusion and actually just realizing just, you know, When I started working on financial inclusion, some of my former partners said to me, oh, that's a bit niche, isn't it? And yeah, there are, you know, as we sit here now, there are 14 million adults in the UK who have less than £100 in savings.
Yeah. Yeah.
14 million. And if you look at characteristics of vulnerability, you've got 27 million people in the UK. Adults in the UK, if I get my words out, that are showing one or more characteristic of financial vulnerability post-crisis. So that's almost 50% of the population. Yeah. And so, you know, with Fair for All Finance, it's this very unique opportunity because we are funded by dormant assets. So we've actually got some money to deploy. We've been allocated £96 million.
I mean, first of all, let's pause for a minute. When I saw that press release, I thought, that's a huge coup.
Yeah.
I mean, that's for those who aren't aware, a lot of countries, what they do is if bank accounts sit dormant for a certain period of time, they revert to the government in some shape or form. And to be able to get 96 million, that massively escalates your war chest,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I have to say, I think it was something that was born out of the coalition government. Some political geek will give me the history of it, but I think it actually came out of the coalition government, the whole dormant assets, you know, idea. And, you know, that's about to be expanded. This is the downside, Tom, is like my mind will wander all over the place in terms of a conversation. So I'll come back. So, yeah, so we're really privileged. We've got some funding from dormant assets and we're not for profit, but we're not a charity. We're not set up as a charity. We're set up with a very clear premise of sitting between government, regulators, not-for-profits who have been campaigning for years in this space, and then actually financial services providers, be those for-profit financial services providers or not-for-profit financial services providers. And the premise in terms of when we were set up was this idea of, well, you know, since the financial crisis, a lot of mainstream financial services organizations withdrew from serving low income, you know, subprime, there are different words for it, but withdrew from serving great tranches of the population. And that had quite a lot of market consequences. You had the rise of the payday lenders,
yes,
which have been and gone. And, you know, the interesting thing you've got at the moment is after the intervention of regulation is you've had a collapse of a whole part of the marketplace that had emerged to serve this customer base, and nothing is there in its place. And the hazard, which you see in other countries, is that actually what happens is organized crime steps in.
Right.
But organized crime money lenders, not your kind of old, you know, baseball bat people, but where it all looks beautiful as a website and stuff, and suddenly you're inveigled into identity theft and all the other things that sort of go with organized crime, who recognize that trading in human beings is even more profitable than trading in drugs and such like. So, you know, there are some really big systemic consequences to where things are at. And our job is to say, well, actually, can we test and prove that you can serve people with unpredictable lives and unpredictable incomes in a sustainable way? How do you design products in that way that work? What are economic models that actually work? And are there groups that can't be served where actually some kind of subsidy or something might be required? So that's kind of what we're trying to do.
So it's fantastic and wide ranging. And looking to focus a little bit, let's talk about this term financial inclusion for me for a moment. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by financial inclusion? So you've noted that the UK, so this is an international audience on this podcast. So the UK is roughly 60 million people. If you're noting 14 million people have less than £100 savings, they're basically, that's poverty. Right. That's 25-30% of the adult population, and roughly half of them are showing one sign of that. But you then refer to financial inclusion. So what does it look like to be financially included?
Really good question. So we define it is that in terms of financial, if to be financially included, that you're able to you're able to access the financial products and services that can help you to deal with life's shocks and uncertainties. And so typically, and interesting, I'm on the board of Leapfrog Investments that focuses on financial inclusion in Africa and Asia as well. So I get a different perspective from there, and where they start is interesting as well. So it's saying, right, well, could someone, you know, withstand an unexpected bill of £500.
Yes.
You know, if your car broke down or your house flooded or something like that, would you be protected so that wouldn't cause an immediate issue? If a life event came on, if you sadly lost a partner, if you had a relationship breakdown, you know, have you got, you know, structures in place so that that doesn't immediately sort of throw you into a tailspin? And so, and when we talk about the, you know, what we're expecting from financial services, it's everything from, can you access a basic bank account? Mm-hmm. Can you access a small amount of unsecured credit when you need it, at a, you know, an affordable interest rate? Mm-hmm. Have you got access to insurance that's actually, you know, doesn't cancel if you miss a payment? You know, so you start to sort of build out this picture of being able to access, you know, the whole point with financial services, what it should be able to do is to afford you the opportunity to build that safety buffer, such that, you know, if a life shock or something hits you, you're not really, you know, stuck in a challenging situation. And I'll give you an example of, you know, an extreme, but when it goes wrong, right? So this is an example that was provided to me by the illegal money lending team in Birmingham, in England, for the international audience. But you'll be familiar with illegal money lenders around the world. So this individual, their post office van had broken down. And in England, if you're a post office worker, then your van you own and it's your responsibility, right? So it had broken down, but they didn't have the funds to repair it. And so their partner had said, well, I've got an old school friend who might be able to help. I think they do something in that space. And so the old school friend lent them the money and they paid them back. And then the old school friend came round and said, well, I need my interest. And they said, well, you didn't say anything about interest, but fine. I'll, you know, pay it. It's an old school friend of this person. 17 years later, this old school friend was an illegal money lender. And the individual ended up in a situation where they'd lost everything. They were living on Mars bars and they'd paid this individual something in the region of £170,000 of everything over the years. And that's because that individual, when their car broke down, didn't have access simply to a small amount of unsecured credit. So it's a really interesting one, just in terms of something as simple as that. The consequences can be enormous.
So, I mean, there are so many angles on this from, you know, one of my past guests, Marla Dukaran, who's a dear friend and Caribbean economist. Her passion is banking the unbanked.
Yeah.
There are huge numbers of people in the Caribbean, and this is spun out of learnings from Africa and Pesa and things like this, about like actually bypassing the technology system. So understand, having a bank account, understanding how to use a bank account, but actually the reality of, we put it in pound sterling, is if what would be the systemic difference if every adult could access £1,000 line of credit, right? And then you start looking at that and say, what is a fair and inclusive society, to use words from the Scottish government? What does that mean? And then you look at not necessarily universal basic income, but you might look at who's going to pay for that, right? And we are in a situation where the libertarians will go, well, everybody has to stand on their own 2 feet. But any objective measure will show that inequality has massively grown across all developed economies in the last 15 years, and particularly since the financial crisis 2008. And you start looking at that, and I look at the Cayman Islands, where I spent most of my life, and it doesn't have a universal healthcare system. And by the way, I am uber grateful for the NHS, because what I just went through came through universal healthcare.
Yep.
The rest of the world, free at point of delivery. We pay for it with our taxes, but everybody gets the same service no matter what their income or assets are. But Cayman doesn't have that, but it does have a well-established and well-designed private healthcare system. But it also, a percentage of the premiums that everybody pays for that go towards those who are financially vulnerable, right? So you're at a situation where you turn around and you go, if you go to a conventional bank, they're going to turn around and go, well, I'm not giving them that because they're not a good underwriting risk. Right. But what it's like, the big picture for me around things like climate crisis is we need massive multi-trillion dollar deployment of capital, change in capital. But it's not the real answer to that is that the global capital has to accept lower returns over the next 20 or 30 years. And if they can accept lower returns, rather than trying to have their cake and eat it, like we'll be all ESG and CSR, but we still want maximized returns, it's never going to happen. But if we drill it down, if we actually said, imagine what a vote winner it would be to, and I think it really would, because I do think the best of people. So while there's some fairly ghastly thinking and voting has been going on in all developed countries in the last number of years, and very polarized, I think people do want to live in a society in which we look after our people. And that's where our taxes go to, in places with income tax. So, you know, what if we actually turn around and said, actually, it's not a matter of windfall taxes and utility companies, but I quite like a parallel idea is when they had a commons committee with all the heads of the big power companies, one of them turned around and said, I thought it was a very progressive and interesting idea to discuss. What if every household below a certain level received £1,000 off their bill next winter, right? And we took it off the people with the higher bills spread over the next X number of years.
Yeah.
As it, you know, it's a Robin Hood thing, but it's fundamentally let's do some income redistribution. Let's do some expense redistribution. And frankly, you know, I sit in that top 1% of the population by any measure, and I'd be super happy to pay that, right?
Yeah. Because
it's the kind of society I'd like to live in. So if it really focused and went, okay, get somebody to put on a manifesto that everybody can access this, and what does it come with? Now, the objections are going to be people aren't going to be responsible with it, etc. And that's going to happen sometimes. And most of the people here are in employment. They're not entrepreneurial, but the real learning, a lot of real learnings can come from, you mentioned you're on LeapFrog's board, but if you look at microfinance in places like East Africa, the level of default on those micro loans is lower than on loans to enterprise, to small to medium sized enterprises. Because, you know, and that loan might be just enough to get a cell phone so you can trade. It might be just enough to buy fabric so you can make clothes. You're talking $100, $200 US.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's in the entrepreneurial space, but there have to be ways to look at this. And I do find it's not fair for all, but it was another similar linked thing. One of my other past guests, a friend of mine, Vanda Wyporska, used to run the Equality Trust, who have great data on all of this stuff. But it was how the less money you have, the more you pay for utilities.
Fair by design. Yes.
Yes, fair by design. Yes. And fascinating work in a niche, but a very important one, because why should it be, from a pure numbers standpoint, absolutely, why should it be you pay more? Because you're higher risk, and that's how underwriting operates. But from a societal standpoint, how do we bridge that gap, whether it's regulators, financial services companies, and politicians? So yeah. I don't know, what would, if you fast forwarded your role and for Fair for All and where you are now, it's obviously been a whirlwind couple of years, but if you fast forwarded to a year from now and you'd been very successful and you'd made one or two key achievements, what would they be?
I think the really interesting thing is that through the pandemic, one of the positives was we found there were all sorts of things that people and organizations had said were impossible to do, that suddenly they found at pace they could when it really mattered, right? And, that thing about the difference, access to a small amount of affordable credit, even if by the end of the year, say every bank was still providing a 250 or a £500 free overdraft to people who had their bank accounts, and people like me, frankly, were paying for my current account to fund the risk on that, I'm happy. The fascinating thing with it, Tom, is that, you know, we say, you know, there is this short-termism in it, in that, you know, people say, oh, we'll look at the underwriting risk and, you know, someone's got to pay for that. The reality is that we are all paying for not providing it. Mm-hmm. Because actually the consequences of people not getting access to it. We did some research with, there's lots of fairs in this industry, Fair for You, which is one of the organizations that we fund, which provides access to household appliances, so washing machines, etc., at affordable rates, you know. Not affordable. It's really interesting. There's a whole interesting discussion in terms of what's affordable. So they're able to provide it at a rate way below the high cost providers and probably what it really costs to, manage and deliver the credit, but way above what you or I would be able to get if we went into a local bank, right? But we did some research with them to find out what was the social impact of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really finding that actually the provision of that small loan to get that appliance or what have you was actually resulting in savings of about £30 a week, cash savings for the individual, plus the health benefits, plus the, you know, both physical and mental health, plus people's ability to actually get into employment. So you get these, you know, these stories of people that are really, really poignant, of the mother who had an autistic son who was regularly wetting himself, and she didn't have a washer dryer, and so she was washing the clothes and often drying them with a hair dryer because she didn't have lots of money for lots of changes of clothes. And so the getting the washer dryer meant that she could actually keep him clean and dry, which saved her time, etc., etc. And then she went for a follow-on loan, which meant she got a bed for him because she'd been sharing a bed with him.
Oh wow.
And exactly, it's that moment of like, oh my goodness. Now, actually, the consequence of that is that he's now sleeping better. He's not being bullied. She's sleeping properly. She's been able to get employment and she's been out supporting her local community in doing things. So, you know, the cost to society of not making that available, we're all paying it. We just don't realize it. Well, and I think that's the really interesting thing, isn't it?
The single biggest, I think by any measure, the single biggest expenditure of the central government in the United Kingdom is on healthcare and social support and everything around that. And one of the great wins of the pandemic, you talked about some of them, the ability to pivot to me, the six most dangerous words in business are, we've always done it this way, right? And so that's gone out the window for a lot of people. But actually talking about mental health has become normal. And I can tell you, I on a very small level, I was in hospital for 9 days after major surgery.
Yeah.
And I've never had a major medical incident in my life. I've been very lucky. And it had a profound impact on my mental state. Being on the ward for 9 days, I really felt kind of altered state at times. Yeah. And I went in there super fit and strong. I found something through proactive screening and it was a very major surgery and I'm fine now. But gosh, you know, being able to say, you know, I genuinely talked to the consultant and instead of saying, how are you? And the very British response, fine. I actually went, no, actually I felt really mentally distressed about this last night. But even me, I would never have said that a few years ago, and talked him through it. And they got me off the ward and home perhaps a bit earlier than they might otherwise have done because they recognized I would be better once I was home. So if we look at mental health, I'd encourage anybody listening to this, and I'd imagine few, if any, have ever been in a position where they were financially not included, where any small shock, where they didn't have £100 and they couldn't access short-term loan to get them through. But it just try to picture a circumstance where you have no ability to handle those basic needs. The nearest parallel I can say for the Cayman audience that listen here is that in 2004, we had a massive hurricane. And everything we thought was normal, we had in terms of, and this is very statistical, it's the most damaging natural disaster in recorded history, according to the United Nations Economics Committee for Latin America and Caribbean, ECLAC, because there was $95,000 of capital damage per capita. 96% of all buildings were badly damaged. And so just imagine, you go out there and the world as you knew it is done. And having money didn't help you.
Yeah.
Did you have nappies for your baby? Did you have fresh drinking water? Where were you going to use the bathroom? Because the drains were blocked. You're in 40 degree temperatures with humidity and mosquitoes and there's no air conditioning, there's no power and there's no cell phones for weeks on end. It was in the Stone Age. So how do you function with that? Some people function and thrive in those environments, many don't.
Yeah.
And it really was a massive wake up call for what matters. So you take a society like that. When the pandemic came around, Cayman did incredibly well because they're brilliant at responding in a crisis. Mm. They're geared up for it. But that's a situation where it's not even about money, but you've just been knocked for six. What we're talking about here is very solvable. And, you know, a parallel by another past show guest is my dear friend Peter Lederer. And we didn't talk about it when he came on, but one of his big ideas, and he ran a very senior guy in business in Scotland for many years. And he had an idea about value in the NHS, which was that everybody receives a bill from the NHS for every service they receive, which is then zeroed out. Right. So if I was in hospital and I had all this stuff, the bill at actual cost to the NHS, which they do measure very well in the NHS now, was probably in the tens of thousands. And it was zeroed out and it said, here's the bill. Nothing to pay, paid for by your taxes. But imagine something like that. Now, just imagine that behaviorally, this is where I need Rory Sutherland to come on, who's the behavioral guy, right? He's coming on the show in a few months. Maybe I'll ask him about this. But imagine you, instead of receiving an increase in your current or checking account bank bill, you receive a Fair for All Finance levy. And imagine if it was literally £2 a month on every current account in the UK, and maybe £5 a month on business bank accounts, right? And you work that out, all of a sudden you've got a huge amount of millions that go in there,
yeah. Right?
And that acts to underwrite this, and perhaps also one of the I accidentally, I didn't even know I'd done it in traffic one time a few years ago, just after I moved to the UK, ran a red light, right? And when you do that, they give you, depending on how egregious it was, and I guess I barely did, you get an option to not have points on your license, but to pay the same amount to do an educational course. And I do a lot of facilitation and historically, and I thought, this is fascinating. I'm going to a course where not one single person wants to be there. And they have to sit through an education course. But the course was so well designed. It wasn't actually, you know, here are the rules of the road, what we call in the UK the highway code. It was actually, it started to prod you about how many of you consider yourself to be an above average driver. And of course, everybody puts their hands up. And statistically, you know, you do a little test and you realize you get some humility in you. And you go, then you start paying attention. And they talk, it was a behavioral course. How do you behave in the road? What would you do if a horse jumped out in front of you? It was nothing to do with speeding or you know, running a red light or anything like this. There's kind of offenses we're all in there for. But it was a genuine educational value. And so what if as part of this, you say to people, you know, certain people in certain circumstances, they go, it's not free money. You have to do some kind of learning. You have to attend something, you know, or you have to give back to the community or do something or other. And they could, you know, I'm brainstorming, but if we just went with this idea of people can access £250 or £500 in unsecured lending, but it's funded, it's not free, but it's funded through, they pay the same rates as say you and I would, which is very low interest rates.
Yeah.
But there'd be recognition written and otherwise that this is funded through a levy on all bank accounts because it's good for society. And the stuff about cost is obvious, right? So this is sort of thing I think could get some cross-party buy-in, which of course is necessary to get much done, you know.
It's interesting because the bit that I was reflecting on in terms of, you know, when I was talking right at the start about frustration about where money is wasted.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I look at the large retail banks in the UK post the financial crisis, you know, obviously, there was a lot of soul searching. There was a lot of actions required on them in terms of Basel I, Basel II, etc. And, you know, now you're in a sort of a situation where, you know, the compliance functions of all of those organisations have grown enormous. Mm-hmm. And we've also got the sort of the sitting there with this sort of, you know, the holy grail of competition, which is, and these banks must not collaborate because that would be a really bad thing for the market. But actually what you end up with is just this colossal amount of waste. So things like anti-money laundering and know your client, every single organization does it individually with their own massive systems that they're doing all the time. And you sort of think, well, who is this actually serving? And if you were designing a system for scratch, wouldn't you actually say, well, it would be better to have one system that everyone could plug into to check, yes, Tom is Tom.
Yeah.
And also, actually, that Tom, who's just come in from the Cayman Islands, really is Tom. And the fact he hasn't lived in a house in the UK for 6 years or what have you shouldn't preclude him from getting a bank account or what have you. You know, imagine just like, you know, if you were able to sort of sit and look at it as systemic basis, saying, right, what are the things that you actually need as the basics for a well-functioning market? How do we do that as efficiently as possible so we can spend the money on what matters most?
I agree. So, you know, if we just send it back to the brainstorm we've been having, mm-hmm. is there's a way in which that could be the concept you've just talked about could be used to sell this access to unsecured finance to the banks by simply saying, this gives you an opportunity to work together. And, you know, do this, ring fence this. If somebody falls in this remit, you ring fence this, you get the regulator's approval to say this is not a competitive thing, this is a societal good. This is cool. I mean, it's cool stuff. Okay. So this is what happens when people come on to have a conversation. We end up just, having conversations about whatever pops up, and sometimes you brainstorm something, other times this something comes up altogether. It's a massively wide-ranging topic. I'm really happy that you do think eclectically and you do think around, and I know you will focus on what you can achieve and what you can get done. But I'm very happy that somebody of your passion and caliber is involved in this, because it's super important work. So it's cool. As you can tell, I'm consciously not trying to keep this within not too big of an overrun, and we've been chatting for a while.
I know.
and we started a bit late anyway. So let me give you some space, as I always do with my guests, to sort of gather your thoughts and give some closing thoughts and ideas, rather than me do as the host, or rather leave it to the guest.
Some closing thoughts and ideas. I think that probably my closing thoughts are just this thing around sometimes problems that can seem intractable because they'd require billions, actually just require billions of people to do maybe one small thing. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, almost that's the idea that we've been surfacing around it of, you know, flipping the problem from flipping the problem, sometimes flipping the problems around and thinking about how then could you actually tackle something quickly, because actually, despite everything going on in the world, we are daily presented with the wonderful humanity that humans possess and the way in which people will open their homes, their arms, their hearts to help people in need. And sometimes the thing that people just want to know is to know, how do I do it? And to be able to see that what they're doing is really making a difference. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's it.
Well, there, I can't remember the phrase, the exact phrase, but there is this sort of theory around it, you know, never always believe that a small group of people around a you know, powerful idea can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has.
Yeah, Margaret Mead.
I kind of butchered it, but the idea is there. So
yeah, it's good.
It's about ideas more than funding, right? So So totally inspiring to talk to you. Fair for All Finance, and Sasha Romanovic is heading up that organization and looking to drive change. Thanks so much for coming on as a guest. Very inspiring, and I hope people look up what you're doing and see what they can learn, what they can do as individuals, what kind of...
Yeah, and any ideas and things that people can help with are more than welcome. And thank you so much, and thank you for anyone who tuned in at 5 o'clock. Tom was very generous. It was completely my fault. I got stuck somewhere the other side of town, and then, the day ran away. So thank you so much for being such a generous host.
Well, I, as you know, most people, it's evolved. It used to be we had quite a large live audience, but now people just go, oh, I'll pod it. And, and they just once a week, they listen to it. So there'll be a bit of catch up because I went dark for 3 weeks, and now I'm very happy you've come on. So such really good stuff to talk about. And I hope we'll talk again soon. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Tom.